Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? Today's guest is Ruby Wax, and frankly, I'm terrified. After all, what can be scarier for an interviewer than interviewing your all-time favourite interviewer? After hosting comedy chat show Don't Miss Wax on Channel 4, Ruby moved to the BBC to host The Full Wax and met Madonna in, well, Ruby Wax Meets Madonna, which in turn led to three series of the brilliant Ruby Wax Meets, in which she tried to get under the skin of public figures as diverse as Imelda Marcos, that is such a classic episode if you can find it online, The Spice Girls, O.J. Simpson and Pamela Anderson. In recent years, Ruby has spoken and written extensively about her experience of clinical depression, qualified with a master's in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and has been awarded an OBE for her work in mental health. So, having spent so many years putting the spotlight on others, what does Ruby see when she takes a long, hard look at herself? Do preoccupations about appearance impact her mental health? And is she already silently judging my interview technique? But it's not all about me, it's about my guest. Welcome, albeit to your own home, Ruby Wax.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so chuffed to meet you.
I could hear that.
I literally do think you're the best interviewer ever. Mm. Before we get to it, your TV show where, Ruby, where you were just around a dinner table, that was my favourite programme for years, and I'm always looking for episodes of it. That was my favorite, when it would be like you and Carrie Fisher and Julian Clary or whoever. Yeah,
trying to fix her up with Salman Rushdie.
Right.
Which I did. They became best friends for the rest of her life. Yeah.
I always thought that show was so ahead of its time, and I think it more and more and more now. It just seemed like such a subversive thing to do, to just have interesting people sitting around a dinner table and talking about interesting stuff, right, with a glass of wine.
And dinner. Yeah.
And it was so ahead of its time, because really it was just about getting under people's skin and hearing about what they thought about and stuff. And I know this has been a real theme for you, so I wanted to kind of start with the head and mindfulness. You're obviously now deeply qualified in this. Tell me, before you did that, why was your interest in mindfulness sparked? What does it mean to you and why does it matter?
Mm. Well, when I was doing the celebrity interviews, mm-hmm. which wasn't my original idea. I wanted to do documentaries about the most eccentric of America, which is just put your hand in and pull out anything. So that was my real pleasure. Doing in Alabama, they would worship, they were fundamentalists and would throw full copperheads and snakes at each other because they took a part of the Bible literally, that if God loved them, they would survive. And mm-hmm. if God wasn't so sure, or you were a sinner, you would be bitten. So I could watch that with that bluegrass music, or I could go to Russia during Glasnost, or I could watch women selling their eggs, or the original beauty contest for five-year-olds. That was my pleasure. And then Louis took over.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because he's a man. But that's another, that's another story. But that was my pleasure. And then they said, would you do celebrities? So I said, I have to do it in the same way. And those were the days where I could spend a week with Pamela, or 35 years with Carrie Fisher. I mean, that's just what happened. Or, I would never just meet them, except Jim Carrey, but he knows how to do comedy.
Yeah.
And Bette Midler would say, or Imelda would say, you have 5 minutes, and then you'd really have to get your foot in and make them laugh and flirt and do whatever you could to extend it to 12 hours. And that's why they look so audacious, because it's actually, you're looking at 12 hours and it's cut down to a half an hour.
Yeah.
So you think, well, how'd she get in bed with her? Or how'd she go through her first? That happened 8 hours later. So it looks like that. But now you couldn't do it because
you don't
PR.
Have the access.
No. And they would say, what are you talking about? And I'd never get to them. And I don't know who's as interesting as Liza Minnelli and Bette Midler and Sharon Stone. You know, those were real starlets. So I don't know how you'd get to them.
Because that's what you're describing is quite a frenetic, crazy environment.
Well, it's actually not. I mean, my first passion was psychology. And I always said, when I went to Berkeley, and I did a little bit, someday I'd return to it. Because I see the mind as a kind of Rubik's Cube. And I'd like to see if I can put it in, at least my point of view, some kind of order. How do they see the world? That's my fascination, is what's going on in your mind. So I was almost doing a personal thesis that you didn't see as an audience. I would ask kind of whatever questions would be provocative or make them laugh. That's how I got in there. Meanwhile, my mind was kind of sitting in a therapist's seat. I wouldn't mention it, but trying to figure it out. What's it like? What's the disease of fame like? Because it is a disease, and who survived it? That was my fascination. And so when my career ended, because I did something terrible, I turned 50. No, that's not allowed.
Unacceptable.
And I thought I looked pretty good, but they have your birth certificate. So they said, get out of here. It's so shocking when it happens, though you know it will, that eventually they just say, oh, well, your shows didn't sell and blah. And meanwhile, they were lying. So I had to quickly dive into my next, I had to reinvent on my feet.
Did you know that would be it? Because you thought you'd always go back to it. Was that your first thought?
In the beginning. And then you get hooked into fame itself.
Yeah.
And you get addicted and you like being treated like a 4-year-old. Yeah. And, you know, you can't help it. It's bigger than yourself. So I had to cold turkey off of fame. That doesn't feel too hot either. Sorry for me. At least I tasted it. I think that's why a lot of them go mad when it leaves them. And it will leave them. It, you know, even when they pay homage to you for turning 100, there's a bitterness. So I thought, well, let's go back to psychology. But that was tough because so many years of being spoiled. But I did. I applied to a school to become a psychotherapist, and I got in. And then I recreated a whole new life, and I got a whole new body image, and I got a whole new mentality. But I knew I wouldn't be a therapist. I just found it fascinating. I knew that's not how I'd end up. And I was a terrible therapist.
Why? You got into bed with your clients.
I got into bed. Because you have to do 400 hours to get your certificate. Yeah. So I did 200 and I had to work at mine. And sometimes some of me was, you know, because I'm a good listener, but sometimes I go, oh, come on, just get to the punchline. I didn't show it, but it made me antsy. And I knew my life wasn't about one-to-one. I eventually got depression so badly that they had to say you can't come to school anymore to learn psychology. Interesting that you get kicked out for having a mental disturbance.
Yeah. Why? Because it was impacting other students?
No, just if you miss too many classes, you have to go back to the beginning. Okay, I understand that, but if we're really smart, we could catch up. So now I had nothing, and it was the most serious depression I ever had, and that was about 15 years ago. And so I started to, think, what can I do so that I can see a depression before it hits me. I knew there's no cure but medication for people who really have a mental disease. So I was on that, but if medication worked, then we wouldn't have relapses. So I hunted out every kind of therapy you could do. So somebody mentioned mindfulness, and in my pajamas, my husband took me to a mindfulness 8-week course. I would show up in my pajamas. Now, you don't really do mindfulness when you haven't got a mind, but something was interesting about it, because you replace the therapist. The way a therapist listens to you with compassion and kind of gives you a container, you know, maybe your parents or your teacher said, no, that's wrong, you can't do that. When you're with a therapist, everything is acceptable, and that frees up, and then neurons start to unwire and you change, but there's a kind of holding pattern. They almost replace the good mother and the good father. And with mindfulness, you're watching your thoughts. They're horrible. They're just as bad as when you tell a therapist, but you learn how to look at them compassionately. So you're cutting out the middleman. So I kind of got how interesting that was, but I was still in a mental institution. And then when I got out, I looked up who was the founder of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Not the founder, but one of the co-creators, and he was a professor at Oxford. So I drove to him. I think I was still in my pajamas. And I met him on Mark Williams. I met him on the street somewhere, and I begged him. I said, what happens in the brain? I need to know what physiological changes happen in the brain. And he said, I'll teach you the 8-week course. I never believed that this could happen. The guy himself said, I'll do it with you. And so he did. I got a private class with Mark Williams. Now, you don't make the depression go away, but you're so aware of the weather condition inside your body. You know, usually you get, when you realize you're going down, you start getting busy.
You're reading the temperature.
I'm reading the temperature.
Constantly.
Yeah. And you know when you're in trouble, and then you might have to see a psychiatrist, or maybe shut down social media, or go away, or have your partner or a friend take over, because you are now starting to slip. I said, I want to learn what happens in the brain. I like the science. He said, you'd have to get into Oxford, because that's where he was a professor. And so I did. And then nobody was as surprised as that man. And then you could watch what happens in an MRI scanner, an fMRI scanner, and see what 10 weeks or what 1 week of mindfulness does. Now, that's not 100%. We're not talking about a miracle. It's just, it's like saying if you go to the gym and do a few sit-ups a day, you're going to see something. So the same with mindfulness. You do see certain areas in the brain become, let's call it, more buff. And that gives you the ability to lower the fear levels and to focus your attention. Now, those are the two keys to the kingdom.
So you're talking about a period of, as you say, quite serious mental illness, and the most kind of learned expert in the field who was then mentoring to you.
Yeah, I'm lucky.
Pretty lucky, yeah. In the real world with somebody who maybe is not suffering anything like as acute as that, who is overwhelmed,
yeah,
who just feels a bit shit,
yeah,
a lot of the time, and who has a busy life, who doesn't have that kind of access, what can somebody do for themselves that is achievable?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I call the frazzled. You know, frazzled,
right,
is a condition,
right,
of everyone. If you're not frazzled in this environment, then something is really wrong with you. So it's for people burning out, people who have kids, they have to keep up with their neighbor, they have to have a social life. You know, everything that burns you out, social media is bumping up your envy, you're never good enough. This is a contemporary illness. That wasn't in existence 100 years ago.
No, because you're constantly comparing people's external world with your internal world, right? It's just ridiculous.
You haven't got a chance.
It's a losing game.
It's a losing game. And it's not your fault. You have to keep saying,
right,
this is not my fault. As if it's raining outside, you need an umbrella. But, you know, the rain is burnout. Really, I've been speaking at companies and businesses and law firms. Everybody's got it. Because you used to think, oh, they're so smart. The smarter they are, the faster they burn out. You need to self-regulate. If you're in a busy office or you're with your kids, you need to bring down, you know, the red mist that's in your mind.
Mindfulness and wellness and those sorts of terms have just become exploited by people who don't understand. They're just kind of landfill words, right, at this point, because people overuse them for nothing, right?
Yeah.
When you say doing it, what does that look like?
So with mindfulness, the equivalent of the sit-up is, in my book, Mindfulness Guide for the Frazzled, you don't have to sit. You could do it at the gym. You can do it when you're with your kids. You can do it cooking. But basically what it is it's watching your thoughts the way a shrink would, which is agony. It's just hideous. But they're there anyway, even if you're not aware of them. That's why you get passive aggression. You know, you have to focus in. You have to check the weather condition and just let them rip. Actually, when you let them rip, they lose a little bit of their ferocity. So you listen to the thoughts, let them go. And then the anchor, or the going back down again, is you bring your focus into the body and you choose one of your senses, which everybody's got. Let's say it's listening. Okay, let's just say bringing it to sound. So gabble, gabble, mind is going. If you bring the focus to just listening, in 2 seconds or 4 seconds, the mind will start gabbling again. But in that, those few seconds that you've brought it to that, or to your breath, or to any sense in the body, your feet on the ground, your bum on the chair, the feel of wind on your face, any physical sensation means that the cortisol is coming down, because you can't have a gabbling brain and sense something at the same time.
Okay.
It can't. It's like trying to drive a car in two gears.
Patting your head and rubbing your stomach.
Right. If you really bring your, even if it's 2 seconds, thoughts don't go away, but they get quieter. So they'll always bring you up. But if you sat for a minute, let's say you were drinking coffee, taste. All right. You notice your thoughts going, what are you doing? You're tasting the coffee. You have to be at the office. Bring it back to the taste. Just really curious. What's the taste? Thoughts will come. You haven't done anything wrong. That's the sit up. Now you lie down, bring it back to the taste. Even if you never got back to the taste, the attempt of it, the up and down motion of thoughts coming back to a sense, this is, and they're teaching athletes to do this now. Listen to the thoughts come back into your body. It means that you're now becoming the master and not the slave. They will never go away, but they'll be more like a radio in another room.
Right.
So only because I looked at a scanner can you see certain areas, anterior cingulate cortex, that gets more neural connections. Just pretend it's muscle. It gets bigger. So that means when you're listening to noise and your computer is telling you to buy shoes and whatever, you're really able to take down that red mist and focus. Now I can focus on things much longer than I could when my mind was a mess. It's not 100% and it's not for everybody, but it's as close as we can get to a mental muscle.
That's the most clear and intelligent way I've ever heard mindfulness described, because I just feel there's so much noise around it. It's become almost like a marketing ploy, right?
Everybody says they go, I can't, you, but yeah, you're different than me. I've got a zillion thoughts and you've got a zillion, I've got a trillion.
Yeah.
I can
yeah.
beat you.
Yeah.
But the point is, we all have it.
Yeah.
And if you didn't, you wouldn't have survived from 100,000 years ago. It's just that there's more stimulation. We needed to know what's in the bushes behind me. What's, you know, am I about to get attacked? That's the amygdala. It shows that you're threatened. The threats now aren't a footstep behind you. It's knowing that there's a war in the Ukraine. My little amygdala can't tell that that's not right behind me.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying shut it down. I'm just saying know it.
Yeah.
Know when you go on social media that, okay, I don't care that she's got nice teeth and has a great husband. Your amygdala feels threat. Somebody's getting to the watering hole and I'm not.
And so if you're bringing these feelings back to your body and being in your body, has all of this changed your relationship with your body? I feel the older I get, the more I feel I've been kind of disrespectful to my body in a way. I didn't like it enough, or I didn't treat it well enough,
yeah,
or whatever, which isn't to say I'm like some Gwyneth Paltrow figure now. But
I bet she's got problems.
I mean, don't we all, I guess, but I feel a bit sorry for my body, right?
If I'm thinking, oh my God, my body was so good 50 years ago, and I don't think that, a bit of me thinks, yeah, that's the radio, that's the old recordings. It's not, some of it might be the truth, but I don't want to give that attention. So you really can sit back and go, it's quick, that needs attention, that doesn't.
You mentioned turning 50 and what that meant then, and frankly what it means now, right? To
yeah.
be a woman in the media who turns 50 thereabouts. And the huge material impact that can have on your career, your perception, mm-hmm. your reputation and all of that. Where do you sit with that now as somebody who, you know, several years down the line since that moment, how is your relationship with that now?
Again, this is entitlement, because I studied psychology before. I had an interest. When you don't have an interest, it's a tragedy, because you hold on to fame for dear life. And that can only end in tears. And I couldn't. I have a real sense of dignity. I just can't. That's great to do whatever show you want. But there's something, a snob in me that just thought, well,
sure.
I really love doing the real documentaries. I don't need to just show up on TV anymore. But I wouldn't have figured that out if I was still going, well, can I still get a job in TV? Do you remember who I was? I never look back at any of my shows except the one they just made me look.
Yeah. Which was, so for anybody who wants to look it up, there was a really great show. It was a kind of retrospective. So it was Ruby looking back on a few of her most kind of iconic interviews, Donald Trump, O.J. Simpson.
It was Ruby Wex Met.
Yeah. And you were talking about the process. It
yeah.
was a kind of behind the
scenes.
I got
to do my own obituary. I was
yeah.
watching my old programs and my kids were making comments on it. Of what I would have done differently.
Those shows are so brilliant. And I was talking to my friend Sarah about it yesterday, because I said I was meeting you and we were both so obsessed with all those shows. And we were saying how absolutely brilliant the Donald Trump episode was. And you made an observation, I think in the retrospective, but I think also at the time, where he was so confused by you, right? He didn't know what to do with you, because it felt as a viewer to me that he was so thrown by you because he didn't want to have sex with you.
Yeah, that's
so that,
clear.
He didn't want to have sex with you, but that's confusing to him, right?
Yeah.
So he didn't want to have sex with you. He was a little bit frightened, but also wanted to frighten you.
He wanted to frighten me, yeah.
He wanted to frighten you. And you were just being a bit too kind of smart and agile around him, and he was really confused by it.
Oh, and that's how you read it?
That's how I read it. But also, he was aggressive towards you. I'm
yeah.
not saying he was passive. He was really aggressive towards
you. He kind of hates women that aren't onto him.
Right.
And
you were clearly onto
him. I'm scared of those kind of men. So I hate those men.
Yeah.
They scare me. He's thrown his power around. He's trying to annihilate me. He was my dad, pretty much.
Right.
So I went into a babbling idiot that I was when I was 12. I couldn't gather. Again, I hadn't done things like mindfulness, where who knows if it would have worked, but I would have been steadier. I would have been able to go, just a minute, anchor, and then be able to you know, let him throw his fury and maybe not catch it so much. You know, throw me your poison, but I'm not going to get poisoned. Whereas I did get, I got toxic. It
really?
Was toxic, yeah. And I felt really, I don't even watch it. He just
does it make you feel funny?
Makes me disgusted.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's me when I was vulnerable as a child, yeah.
That's so interesting. Do you feel, being a, you're a little person, right? I'm a little person, so I relate. Do you feel that's useful in those situations, or do you ever feel physically intimidated around those ridiculously large characters, large in every way?
Well, no, I've met Roseanne and, you know, big characters. Carrie Fisher is a huge character, even though she's small. But if it becomes a love affair, and they did, then that's overpowering in a glorious way. Bill Cosby is a criminal, and he tried to choke me when I first met him in a loving way. You know, he put his arm around my neck.
Okay.
I got his number, but you feel dirty again. Uh-huh. I should just walk away. It's not my business to pass judgment on these guys, but just save yourself. Take a breath, ground your feet, and then just listen. Let them hang themselves. You know, a lot of times when I get nervous, I become a three-year-old. So I did become a young girl trying to ward off somebody really scary. I don't think that's good TV. I think good TV is when I'm with Carrie Fisher and I'm loving her.
Those conversations with Carrie Fisher are obviously just, they're a gorgeous, mutually loving, respectful, so funny thing. When you're with, even when you're with the not nice people though.
There was only a couple.
Yeah. O.J. Simpson, that's a terrifying interview.
Actually, he didn't scare me.
The bit at the end with the banana?
Yeah, but I had a camera crew with me. He tried to stab me with a banana, but there's a whole crew with me.
Unsettling.
It was unsettling, but I thought, this is good TV.
Well, but he if anyone was
he
in
He was so
bad.
Out of his mind yeah. that it wasn't a threat, whereas Cosby and Trump know how to hurt. They know your weak spot. OJ's just out of it.
You mentioned before at the top, I think, that you adopt this kind of flirtatious manner mm-hmm. in those situations. What is that? That sort of need to charm? Is that the three-year-old thing again, where I need to charm?
Well,
my
it's
way
my defense. You know, I have to pretend I'm like just a little girl and I'm asking really stupid questions so that you don't hurt me, instead of being mature and knowing how a shrink would work it. And I'm not saying I would be a shrink, but I'd be able to zero in on their bullseye, but with charm.
So you had to watch those old episodes for that retrospective. Is that what makes you uncomfortable about watching them, feeling?
Only those two. The other ones I thought, oh, did I have a good time? I remember how wonderful.
Who did you have the best time with?
To Carrie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Pamela Anderson.
So I've interviewed Pamela Anderson. I loved her.
I loved her.
Yeah, she's
a girl's girl.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She's a good woman. You've interviewed so many celebrities and you mentioned the kind of condition of fame, whether it's them or you. What commonality do you notice between people who want to be famous?
Well, want or are famous and why?
Okay, well, tell me the distinction because I'm interested
in that too. Well, those women had talent. They could act or they could sing. As crazy as Liza Minnelli is, when she sings in your face, you're dealing with a diva. So now, I don't want to sound like a snob, but if you're just famous for showing up on TV, it's not interesting. And I wouldn't even know what to say. But I know that that's the stars of now. So it's better I did what I did and now just get on with it.
But there's something about Liza Minnelli isn't just an amazing singer, an amazing dancer, an amazing entertainer. She's also a star, right?
But that makes her a star.
Not
her
that
talent.
She really had much choice but to be a star. Like, she was
yeah,
always going to be a star.
Yeah, but the star is defined by you have a skill. That's to me. Okay, we'll disagree on it.
Well, I think she has all of that, but she has something extra. I think she has something
But if she couldn't sing, she'd be crazy. That's the difference. If she couldn't sing, we would just be watching somebody who might not just be walking around anymore.
And what are they grieving for when it goes away, whoever it is, whether they...
Well, you know all those people from those reality shows. You know, there's been some suicides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe it's still on. People keep killing themselves. I can't believe it's still on.
But they get a taste of adoration, and that's the illness. It tastes really good. It's like any addiction, and then it goes away. And then that's their farewell to their self-respect.
It's not real it's not real adoration. And so when you mention yourself that your career ended, was it the work you missed or was it that?
Or both?
Both. But what's funny now is now I am working again.
Yeah, you're properly working.
Going on an island to live by myself, which you could say is a reality show. But I think at this age, and when I wrote my book, I want to try things I've never tried before.
Yeah.
So the camera crew aren't always with me. And I get to, I've done 30-day silent retreats where you meditate 13 hours a day. That's an experiment where people go, "Are you did what?" But I'm really into what happens when you... What do you learn when? It's just my, I don't want to suffer. The opportunity for somebody to say, you can go to an island. We're on the next island watching. The camera crew isn't always there. And I can see what happens to my mind after 10 days. I'm not going in with no strength. I mean, I have done 30 days, so 10 ain't so hard.
30 days without speaking?
That's my happy place, not speaking. The hard bit is the 13 hours of doing mindfulness a day. But what happens? You're able to, you don't get bored. You just sit there watching, I don't know, a leaf. It's fascinating. There is no, the distractions have been taken. So by the end of the month, a bit of me is thinking, I'm doing this another month, which means you're very present. Everything becomes quite poignant and you do feel connected to everybody else.
What has it meant to you where the first part of your career was all about, your kind of first act, I suppose, was all about entertaining, questioning, revealing, exposing? Mm. Now you have a very direct, benefiting others role. You're helping people as well as presumably yourself as somebody who has suffered from mental illness herself. Does that satisfy or fulfill you in a way that was previously missing or not?
I wrote this book now that comes out in May called I'm Not As Well As I Thought I Was.
It's a very good title.
It's a good title.
It's a good title.
And then I'll do a show with it. But that really is about, at the end, I read this book, it's not about him, but Richard Rohr, who talks about first act of life and second act of life, but it almost has nothing to do with age.
Yeah.
Is that the first half, you're supposed to be in turbo. You are building an ego.
Yeah.
You're supposed to compete. You're supposed to, that's how you root yourself. You have to feel important.
Yeah.
All these human needs. In the second half, and that can come at any time, you open it up a little bit. You're able to tolerate unhappiness and loneliness and whatever, you can really hold it. And if you can hold that, you know, and accept, then you can help other people. If you're still full of ambition and whatever, there's too much red mist in your head. I can't even empathize with you. I'm too busy with myself.
Yeah.
So the second half is not peeling down the ego because, you know, you need to exist, but sort of going, okay, I've learned, this is wisdom now. I've learned I can hold my own. Even though it's, you know, humans still suffer and I'm still envious and I still don't like bits of me, but I can really empathize with you. And the second half is about give it back.
When are you most comfortable in your own skin?
When I'm meditating. Not all the time. I mean, I sit down and I go, I hate my body. I hate sitting here. This is so uncomfortable. Maybe I better get surgery on my knees. I'm so old. This is disgusting. Sitting there. And sometimes because I'm maybe in the half an hour, I'll notice a breath. I might notice two. And in those moments, I'm free. And nature, obviously, whenever I become insignificant, I'm happy. If I'm the center of attention, and that's why television is hard for me again. When I did Trailblazers, I'm comparing myself to Emily or Mel, and they're beautiful. But when I was young, I'd compare myself to Sharon Stone and some of the most beautiful women on earth. And they were unhappy too. I remember Sharon going, oh my God, look at these wrinkles on my knees. Every time I look down, I can hear the clock ticking. So everybody's unsatisfied. You think Pamela was satisfied with her body?
Yeah.
She said she was too fat.
Yeah.
When I met her. And she had 2 inches of waistline.
I've spoken to so many people who are surrounded by kind of freakishly good looking people for their job, whether they're makeup artists or hairdressers or, in your case, interviewing people. And in that moment, because of the age you were, which is obviously a lot younger and probably less wise and having gone through your kind of mental health journey, were you thinking, Jesus Christ, like, I'm going to look bad in this shot next?
With Goldie Hawn, she was in a bathtub.
I remember that one, yeah.
I refused for them to see me in a bathing suit. I wore a robe into the jacuzzi. And you know how great my body was? I wasn't Goldie Hawn. What was I talking about? And when I did my early interview shows, I insisted on wearing high necks because I thought my neck, I was 30 years old.
It's insane. But it's that Nora Ephron thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you turn 16, put on a bathing suit, don't take it off till you're 45.
Like,
because
that's funny.
Never,
that's good.
You will never, ever know until later how hot and amazing you looked for that whole entire period.
I know. And I mourn it. I'm sad. But, you know, I kind of know those are thoughts a little bit. Those are my recordings. That I heard early recordings, you're not good enough, you know, look at you, you're ugly, you know, from my parents. So sometimes I think, oh, like an old recording is playing.
Would they literally say that?
Yeah, they did. They said I was stupid. They said I would never amount to anything. I was like, I looked like a boy. They said no one would ever go out with me. So I hear it. It's not as loud as it was. And it's more like when you form a scar, it gets fainter and fainter. But I still hear it. And I think that's what makes me human.
So when you absolutely objectively...
Did you notice you're wearing the same earring?
Oh, yeah, the safety pin?
Yeah.
I never take it out, do you?
I only just got it.
I realize
that's how you're cool.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to go... That's blown my mind that your parents said that. As you were growing up, then, you must have been really aware. If they're pointing out to you and describing how you look, as a tiny child, you must have been really conscious of how you looked in the outside world when you weren't with them. You must have carried it.
Oh yeah, I mean, I didn't go out with boys for a really long time. I wouldn't show my body for a really long time. I'm still pretty self-conscious. You know, I don't walk around nude.
I mean, my father said never trust the physically uninhibited.
That's funny.
I mean, of course, they're fine. I'm not, there was some self-awareness in that statement. But yeah, I mean, neither. I'm not a bikini parader. So
yeah.
It sounds like you're not either still.
But I could have worn it.
Yeah, of course.
I didn't know.
Of course.
How do you, at 30 or 20, I was in my 20s, wear a high neck polo. I made all the costume make me a high neck polo neck for every show. I was in my 20s.
Because you thought your neck was raw.
Deteriorating. Yeah. What was I thinking?
And now what do you feel about your neck?
It is deteriorating. It is deteriorating.
But are you better with it? You're not wearing a polo neck now, you're wearing a
polo neck. No, I know. But if I look in a mirror, I get upset.
You do?
Yeah. Or a photograph. You know, you're sad. You kind of mourn it. But, you know, it can't ruin my life.
No.
Yeah. And then I can get down the, you know, when you realize, compared to the cosmos and the history of human existence. Get real.
See, you still feel it, but you notice the feeling.
Yeah, there's an awareness. And again, that's mindfulness. There's a bigger awareness. You're not caught in the ego. There's something bigger. Well, which is a part of the brain that gives you interception, awareness, a bigger basket to hold your feelings rather than just this little narrow part of your brain trying to figure out, why do I feel so ugly? Whose fault is it? That'll drive you insane. Whereas I go, oh, those are the recordings.
So you're partly why we're here today. It's you're working with rituals with your mental health hat on, not your television hat. You're working with rituals about finding those little pockets. Those little pockets in life where you can stop. And so,
well, you don't stop, but I mean, I what I did for rituals is I gave a five lessons in mindfulness. You know, I make it accessible and I have a sense of humor, and it's things you could do for 1 minute a day. But, you know, from being present to being able to self-regulate, bring down the cortisol, to being able to do it while you're moving, to do it, but always for maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
So the link will be in the show notes. So anybody who wants to access these masterclasses. So Ruby has done 5.
Yes.
Yeah. So 5 masterclasses and they are 40 minutes each. See, I immediately know I'm going to do them 100% because I've never understood mindfulness until this very day. So you can click on the link and Ruby has done these masterclasses and you can just fit them. The idea is you can just fit them into everyday life. You don't have to have access to a mental health professional because you've got Ruby and she is one. And you certainly don't have to spend lots of money and spend loads and loads of time, but it's about snatching that time to reconnect.
Anytime you're not busy and your brain is going 10,000 miles an hour, it won't stop, but you're getting more control over it. You don't have to listen to the 40. I do exercises that you can do along with me. So I'm taking you through it. It's much easier. It's like having training wheels on the bike, and then you can remove them. But really, it is 1 or 2 minutes.
I could talk to you all day. You're so brilliant, Ruby Wax. All of the links to Ruby's project with Rituals, which is free. You can access it for free, so you have your own expert mindfulness coach in your own home. Try not to wander onto social media before or after. Take a moment for yourself. They are brilliant and they are accessible, and everything will be in the show notes, and I'll also put them on Instagram so you can access them there. Ruby Wax, thank you so much. I'm thrilled that
you
agreed to do this. It was just so brilliant to talk to you.
No, and you too. And we have the same earring.
We do have the same earring, which is some kind of sign or something.
Yeah, we're connected.
Some bullshit. I'm taking it as a connection. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Please subscribe and follow to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with my next guest. Bye.
Insanity Group.